When I get settled. Perhaps you've said those words yourself, or you've heard other people say it. When I get settled, it means at the moment I'm too busy, too pressured, too fraught, too uncertain. I'm fending off this problem over here, and I'm fending off that problem over there. But one day, when I get settled, I will be able to whatever it is we really want to do in the future. Now, the people of Israel found that getting settled can take an extremely long time. In fact, it took many centuries. But one day they were settled. And this is the day that we read about as we open 1 Kings chapter 5. In fact, if you look at verse 4, Solomon is able to put it into words, and he says in verse 4, "But now, at last, the Lord my God has given me rest on every side, and there is no adversary or disaster." At last, we have rest. And then he went on, "I intend, therefore, to build a temple for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord told my father David." And this ultimate, in human terms, building contract would be a new build. Until then, the Jews had no temple. There'd been a people on the move. And so their religious center was portable. It was a tent. It was a tent of meeting. And within it was the Ark of the Covenant. Now, it didn't sound very much, but this Ark of the Covenant was a box. And this box contained two tablets of stone inside it. And those slabs were historic. They were very precious. They were the words of the law that had been given to Moses on Mount Sinai or Horeb 1,000 years before. But with the coming of Solomon, and it was David who was first brought into this idea that God told him to do, at last the ark was to have a permanent resting place. And this temple that housed the ark would take 7 years to build. The contract, of course, was very prestigious. It wasn't just to be a great building. But as God himself called it, it was to be a temple for my name. Now, the record that we have of the building covers three chapters. In fact, we've got quite a few chapters to look at this morning, and three chapters are about the building of the temple. For us, it's going to be done and dusted in just 3 minutes. So you'll need to have your eye open for chapter 5 to begin with in a moment. And as we look at these chapters, we're going to ask the question, was it too expensive? The temple would never come cheap, and we'll discover that. And today we tend to question anything that might prove expensive, especially if it comes out of our pockets because we're giving taxes, like hosting the Olympic Games or the royal wedding next April. And in these days, I'm sure a project of this kind, maybe particularly at this time in our history, would be bound to have its critics. And we will come to consider the question, too expensive? In a moment. But first, the temple itself. Let's have a look at chapter 5, which is all about the materials. The materials would not be homegrown. And there were to be nothing but the best. The timber was to be cedars of Lebanon. They would need, of course, to be felled abroad and floated down on rafts by sea. And the stone, the quality stone, would also be quarried in that area. Though the whole thing was massively labor-intensive and logistically demanding, as you'll see in verses 15 to 18. Let me read those, chapter 5, 15. Solomon had 70,000 carriers and 80,000 stone cutters in the hills, as well as 3,300 foremen who supervised the project and directed the workmen. And at the king's command, they removed from the quarry large blocks of quality stone to provide a foundation of dressed stone for the temple. And the craftsmen of Solomon and Hiram and the men of Gebel cut and prepared the timber and stone for the building of the temple. And all this was made possible through an alliance, which we read about in our reading, between Hiram, who was king of Tyre, and Solomon, who was king of Israel. And they had what we now call in these days a special relationship. Hiram was friendly, but he was also, as we see a bit later, very businesslike too. And then we move into chapter 6. We've got the materials already. What about the design, the plan? Well, an accurate reconstruction of the temple would be a little bit difficult because there are not enough details. But we know the basic plan. There was the entrance hall and there was the sanctuary, the inner shrine, the Holy of Holies, as it was sometimes called, the most holy place where the ark would be kept. And there were courtyards. And as you read through chapter 6, perhaps you're sort of having a quick waft through the chapter as I talk about it, you will find there's no human story at all. You can hunt for it as much as you like, but it's not there. It is simply about this building. And verse 1 tells us when the building began, and we get to the end of the chapter, verse 38, and it tells us when the building was finished. And so we're now ready to move on to chapter 7, which is largely about the furnishings. Although when we begin chapter 7, the first few verses tell us that the temple was not the only new building. It was part of a complex. And it included also the royal palace and the justice hall. But although the royal palace took quite a lot longer to build, it was probably a bigger building, the emphasis is on the temple. What about these furnishings? Well, again, there was no expense spared. Now, we find interesting things as we look through chapter 7. We find, for example, in verse 23, it talks about the sea. What was this sea? Well, it seems it was vast water containers, primarily the water for cleansing purposes, in part of the temple rituals. And wherever we look with the furnishings and the furniture that was required, if it wasn't bronze, made of bronze, expertly crafted by the very best they could find, if it wasn't bronze, then it was going to be gold. Let me read out verses 48 to 50, page 344, just to give us a feel of the kind of quality that was involved in building this temple. Verse 48, Solomon also made all the furnishings that were in the Lord's temple. The golden altar, an altar which would be fundamental to the whole business of the sacrificial system. The altar, the golden temple, table on which was the bread of the presence. The lampstands of pure gold. The gold floral work and lamps and tongs. The pure gold dishes, wick trimmers, sprinkling bowls, dishes and censers. And the gold sockets for the doors of the innermost room, the most holy place. And also for the doors of the main hall of the temple. It was expensive. Now we come to this question, was it too expensive? I think the answer we get is apparently not. But whenever we're spending money, even if it's for the Lord's work in one way or another, we think, there are questions that it's good for us to ask. It doesn't apply just to us on a sort of individual level, but also on a national level sometimes. And here are the two questions to ask. And sometimes we may ask the same question and get different answers. First of all, a good question is, will it be too extravagant economically? Now, the second chapter of the second half of chapter 9 implies that Solomon was beginning to run short of funds, perhaps because of all this expenditure on the temple and his palace and so on, so much so that he had to strike a new deal with Hiram to refill the coffers. And of course, he relied very heavily on forced labor. It's just a reminder for us that economic decisions must always take into account not only what we would like to happen, but also at the same time the needs of the poor, and to recognize that rash spending and lending should always be held in check. Too extravagant economically, there's another question. Is what we're doing too expensive spiritually? Solomon was getting heavily involved with countries that didn't share his own faith in the one God. Hiram of Tyre was one, but there were many others. And Solomon was showing special favors to Egypt. Let me just read out one of the verses that comes later in these few chapters. It just happens to mention that after Pharaoh's daughter had come up from the city of David to the palace that Solomon had built for her, he constructed the supporting terraces. Big favors for people outside their own kingdom. Now, it's not necessarily always wrong, but Solomon actually went too far. And his foreign wives would turn his heart after foreign gods. What does it say to us and to our country? Well, Christians and governments are not to be isolationist. But the hidden costs of commercial ambitions must also be taken into account. I don't envy David Cameron walking tightropes all the time in his dealings with other countries. And the United Kingdom is far from perfect anyway. But always questions must be asked. For example, how will our foreign policy and commercial interests affect the spiritual health of our own country and also human rights issues abroad? And China's not the only country we think about. There's a good question. Solomon should have been more aware of the dangers. But the temple itself that he had built was acceptable to God. Extravagance in itself is not always wrong. Remember the lady who poured the ointment out over Jesus. There were people muttering in the background, "What about the poor?" Now Jesus cared about the poor more than the people muttering in the background, but he said, "She has done a beautiful thing for me." And maybe in our relationship with God, we should be asking about extravagance. Are we extravagant in what we offer to God? Are we giving the Lord the best of our energies, of our time, of our resources, of our lives? Just yesterday, somebody we've known for a long time held a little party. It was an informal get-together. Hilda and I were invited. I wasn't able to go, but Hilda went along. And it was to acknowledge that 40 years previously, it was an anniversary, 40 years previously, he had become a Christian. And as he was talking a little bit about his life, he said one thing that he had found very helpful was to stop every now and again, not just once in his life, but stop every now and again in his life and ask the question, what is the best way? What is the best way I can spend my life for God? Well, we thought a little bit about the temple. We're going to ask some more questions in a moment because at last the temple was ready. And we're coming now into chapter 8, and that's going to be our focus for the next little while. Because at the beginning of chapter 8, we see now it's all ready, and therefore King Solomon summoned all his guests, so everybody who wanted to be there, in fact, it was just about everybody, they all came together to Mount Zion, to Zion, the city of David. And it was in order to bring up the Ark of the Lord's Covenant. The building was ready. The Ark of the Covenant had to be placed within it. So all the elders of Israel, verse 3, when they had arrived, the priests took up the Ark. And they brought up the Ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the sacred furnishings in it. The priests and the Levites carried them up. And King Solomon and the entire assembly of Israel that had gathered about him were before the Ark, sacrificing so many sheep and cattle they could not even be recorded or counted. And then, verse 6, the priests brought the Ark of the Lord's Covenant to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place. Just imagine being there. It was very exciting. It must have been very emotional. And then when all that had happened, it says in verse 10, when the priests withdrew from the holy place, then the cloud filled the temple of the Lord. And the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled his temple. And then we begin to ask a question that Solomon himself asked. Was the temple actually too small? It's a nightmare when we make something and it turns out not to be big enough, like a grandmother perhaps, who very lovingly makes a little cardigan for the new grandson. Takes a bit of time over it, and then eventually the day comes for the fitting to take place. And it's evident to everybody that on one hand, the cardigan is too small, and on the other hand, that the baby is far too large. And what about this temple? Was it too small? Well, technically, no, it wasn't. It wasn't as big as this, probably. But when we build a church, we want to provide space for all of us, for the congregation. That's a very important element in our planning, whether it's All Souls Church or St. Paul's Cathedral, wherever it is. But the Jewish temple was not built for lots of people. It was built to house the Ark of the Covenant. And there were courtyards where the people could assemble outside. But this question, was it too small, was raised not by the spectators or the critics or the press the day after. It was raised by Solomon himself. Let me just read what he says in verse 27. He's speaking in prayer to God. But will God, verse 27, really dwell on earth? The heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you. How much less this temple that I have built? We know that God was content for his name to be there. He didn't turn around, as it were, and disown the place as unworthy or inappropriate or not big enough for his name. In fact, the response to the dedication ceremony was very positive, as we will discover in the next chapter. And yet, there was no way that this building, or any building, could ever be big enough for God. So when we're asking this question, too small, inevitably the answer is going to be yes. Technically not, but for God, of course it's going to be too small. And Solomon said that on the day they opened the temple. He said it here. He said, as I read out a moment ago, the heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you. How much less this temple I have built. We sing sometimes about God is so big because he's indescribable and he's uncontainable and he's incomparable and he's unchangeable. God is so big. Solomon wanted the people to think about God. He didn't use this occasion to talk about the temple or himself, anything like that. And it's vital we grasp what he was saying. There are things that we don't understand about God. But these things are not all problems. God himself is not a problem. He becomes a problem when we reduce him in size to human dimensions, when we compare him or anything with anything or anybody else. And Solomon says, there is no God like you. God is not an extra-large version of any other being. Immediately Solomon entered that building, he knew that the temple was totally upstaged by God himself. I find a little book by Os Guinness always very helpful, and he says this. He says, if we believe in God, yet at the same time presuppose a picture of God that is less than he is, our faith is bound to suffer. Our conception of God will be pinched and uncomfortable. Confronted with a shrunken picture of God, faith has no room to be itself. You can't be contained within any building, within any universe, or within anyone's mind. But although God is so big, yet God is not too big to listen to our prayer. And Solomon knew that, and he didn't even go on to preach a great sermon or deliver a speech. He actually went on to pray a long prayer. And there it is, and nearly in the rest of chapter 8. And he prayed that his people would be forgiven for various sins that they had not even yet committed. But they might. Just supposing, what if? These were questions he raised as he went through from verse 31 up to 51. If you take one example, verse 33 is just over the page. That little paragraph there, verse 33 of chapter 8. Solomon prayed, when your people, Lord, when your people Israel have been defeated by an enemy, because they have sinned against you, and when they turn back to you and confess your name, praying and making supplication to you in this temple, then hear from heaven and forgive the sins of your people Israel, and bring them back to the land you gave to their fathers. He was asking, in effect, are you a God who will forgive, even when we do wrong in the future? Or are you so huge and unbending that we have no chance? And all of us need to know the answer to that question. And the answer is, if we turn away from our sin, and we turn back to God, he will graciously forgive us. And what is expressed in this great service of dedication was that God had great glory and he also has great mercy. And so we come to the last of these questions about the temple. The question really is, would it last? The people of Israel not only wanted to be settled, they wanted to feel secure. I heard an old German woman on the radio some time ago reflect on the rise of the Nazis in the 1930s, and I think she was very sad about that element of their history. And she was reflecting on why it was that all this was allowed to happen. And she said simply, it's because we felt secure. And feeling secure is a basic instinct. And on this day that the temple was dedicated, would God be able to give his assurance that in the future, they would be, as a nation, spiritually secure? In other words, are there any guarantees? And now we come to the last of the chapters we're looking at, and we will only dwell on the first 9 verses. Chapter 9, what God said sounded very reassuring. Just have a look at the beginning of chapter 9. When we get to verse 3, the Lord said to Solomon, he said, I've heard the prayer and plea you've made before me. I have consecrated this temple, which you have built, by putting my name there forever. And then, rather amazingly, he goes on and says, my eyes and my heart will always be there. In other words, you ask if there are any guarantees. As far as I'm concerned, the answer is yes. One person in Ireland we were speaking to last week on the phone summarized the current feelings that are around, certainly for her. She said, we can't trust the church anymore. We can't trust the banks anymore. We can't trust the government anymore. But when we read this passage, we hear God saying to the Israelites, as he would say to us today, but you can trust me. I will not go back on my word. And that is the guarantee. But this is not just about me, it's also about you. And therefore, when it comes to the question about are there any guarantees, yes, as far as God is concerned, but there is a big question mark about our part in all this. As regards the ongoing line of David and the long-term security of the temple and my name there, says God, in the end, it's up to you. Will you be faithful to me? Because if not, there's definitely no guarantee. And in these verses, he set out two options, one in 4 to 5, that's option 1, and then the other one in verses 6 to 9, that's option 2. Option 1 in 4 to 5 says, as for you, if you walk before me, then it's going to be fine. Option 2 says in verses 6 to 9, as for you, if you turn away from me, then it's not going to be fine, it's going to be ruined. In fact, literally, for the temple, some ruins can be quite inspiring. But God says, if you don't keep walking before me, this is going to be not an inspiring one at all. That ruin will become an object of ridicule. Now, I think many of us know that our security lies not in the building. But we just need that reminder that actually it lies instead in our daily, obedient walking with God. When the temple falls to an invading army, as it did, as we look on a few centuries, its demise, says God, will reflect on you, says the Lord. The people of God will be asked to learn the hard way. The fall of the temple would not signal the end of God, however. They wouldn't find his remains in the ruins. Of course not. And when Jesus came, he said about the temple, he said, we are God's temple. Those who turn to Christ, we are his dwelling place. The dedication of the temple was a personal experience for the people of Solomon's day, perhaps the greatest day of their life. But the message from God asks us the same question, even though we weren't there at the time. Will we take option 1 and walk with God? Or will we take option 2 and turn away from him? And as far as I can see, there is no option 3. Although some people can go on for years without making any clear decision for God at all, one way or the other, nothing conclusive. Some assume that we are in unless we decide otherwise. We decide to opt out. But in reality, we have to make a decision to opt in, to walk with God in our hearts and in our life. Now, in a communion service, one of the good things about it, apart from the central theme of thinking about the cross of Jesus, is it does give us a little quiet space. And I want to make two quite practical suggestions as to what you do in the quiet space. You don't have to take my recommendation. You can do what you like in that time. But here are two suggestions. One is that we actually look in the Bible for a prayer, and I'll tell you what it is. It's 1 Kings chapter 8 and verses 56 to 61. 1 Kings chapter 8, 56 to 61. Now, you can use it for yourself, and this is really what I'm suggesting, either today or another day, but you actually keep it within your list of useful prayers for the future. It's the kind of prayer that we always need. It's so warm and reassuring. It actually says how dependent we can be on God. And yet it also ends with a challenge, the kind of challenge that never goes amiss. So let me just read it through first. Verse 56, praise be to the Lord, who has given rest to his people Israel, just as he promised. Not one word has failed of all the good promises he gave through his servant Moses. May the Lord our God be with us, as he was with our fathers. May he never leave us or forsake us. May he turn our hearts to him, to walk in all his ways and to keep his commands, decrees and regulations that he gave our fathers. And may these words of mine, which I have prayed before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night, that he may uphold the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel, according to each day's need, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God, and there is no other. But your hearts must be fully committed to the Lord our God, to live by his decrees and obey his commands, as at this time. Now, if you're able to remember that one, the other passage which I'm going to suggest you have a look at today, and any other day, when you want to think about the sacrifice of Jesus, this is where we finish. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 24 to 26. I'll give you the page number. It's page 1207. Hebrews 9, 24 to 26, page 1207. Now, we caught just a glimpse of the fact that the activity in the temple was all around sacrifice. There wasn't just one token cow. There were thousands of sheep and all the rest who were sacrificed day after day. But the temple would not only become a ruin, the whole sacrificial system would one day become redundant. And when Jesus came and he died on the cross, that system became no longer necessary. All those sacrifices. The problem of sin hasn't gone away in the meantime. We still mess up. We still need to come back and recognize that we can be saved from our sin. And what Hebrews tells us in these verses is, first of all, in these two or three verses, 24 to 26, what Jesus did not do. The contrast to all we've been thinking about with this temple. For Christ did not, verse 24, enter a man-made sanctuary. There was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself, now to appear for us in God's presence. Nor did he enter heaven to offer himself again and again, the way the high priest enters the most holy place every year, with blood that is not his own. Then Christ would have had to suffer many times since the creation of the world. That's what he didn't need to do. So what did he do? Well, it says in the rest of this particular verse. And that's good for us to read, not only days like today when we come to communion, although it has a particular relevance to what we're doing here today. It's good for any day of the week. But this is how he finishes that verse. But now, he, Christ, has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself.